Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, Thunderbolt on Windows. We've got benchmarks, people. AMD's Radeon 7970. Does gigahertz really make a difference? Core i5 3470. Ryan built a PC blindfolded. The best $200 GPU, Google Nexus 7. And a ridiculous but silent GTX 680. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 176, recorded July 5th, 2012. Thunderbolt on Windows.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com and use offer code TWITCH7. And they now offer free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm your host, Patrick Norton, and this is the show where we try to bring you the most important news in hardware each and every week. Computer hardware, primarily. CPUs, GPUs, motherboards, power supplies, and I'll be honest with you, we're pretty big on tablets, too. Joining me, as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout, who is still deep in the heart of Texas. How are you, Ryan?
I'm not going to sing the song for you, though. But I am here. I'm here one more week. So next week, chances are I will be back at the regular office, all things, if they go as planned. And yeah, I had a lot of fun down here. I did not eat the Migas. I know you were going to ask. I've still got like 4 or 5 days. It can happen.
You're killing me, man.
And it's the weekends, so you never know.
Now you have to have the Migas just so I can hear you go next week. Dude, they were amazing. I would have eaten them every day if only I tried.
Actually, that happened to me. We found a pizza place like right near our place called Double Dave's. And we went there
pizza in Texas
2 days ago, and I was like, it was great. And they had like dollar pizza rolls, right. And they had all kinds of pepperoni rolls, something like that. But it was great. And I was like, wow, I wish I'd known this was here 3 months ago. Oh well.
Just remember, more barbecue before you go home.
Yes.
AMD Radeon HD 7970, 3 gigabytes. Or the 3 gigabytes gigahertz. Gigabytes or gigahertz? The 7970 gigahertz edition has 3 gigabytes of memory on it.
There you go.
Does it do a single delete expletive thing for gaming performance, the extra memory?
No. The 3 gigs has always been there, right? So the 3 gigs of memory on the 7970 is there. It does, if we compare it to like the 2 gigs on the GTX 680, there can be some differences when you start getting into the super high res 3-panel gaming. For 1080p and maybe even for 2560 by 1600, like your 37-inch or your 27-inch Cat Leap panels that we were kind of discussing before the show, probably won't make that much of a difference. The new part here is that it's a gigahertz edition, which I really kind of have a thing against that moniker just in general, because the clock speeds don't really matter in the end. We went through this whole thing like eight years ago. The point of it is the default 7970 when it first launched late last year was 925 megahertz clock speed, and this one starts at 1,000 megahertz and actually introduces what they are calling a power tune with a boost, which might sound familiar to you if you follow the GTX 680 Kepler launch and that kind of stuff. And because the technology works in a very similar way. If you have thermal headroom, it will clock as high as 1,050 megahertz. Although what was interesting to me, and I had these discussions slash arguments with the AMD people, was they're very adamant that every Radeon 7970 card performs identically in each user's system, regardless of what other components they have, regardless of what their system configuration is, regardless of what the temperature inside their case is. They were very adamant that that provided the best user experience, that you knew that the card you were going to buy was going to perform at X levels, no matter what other components, I don't want to say components, but what other system environments, you happen to be in. And NVIDIA was kind of on the other side of that. They were like, well, some of these GPUs will perform better than other GPUs in certain situations. And there's going to be these small fluctuations from part to part that you actually can buy. And there's a potential for some people to get upset if they get the lower end of that compared to their friend who may get the upper end of that. But I don't think the variance is very high. But they're sticking with that with the 7970 gigahertz edition, even though they have boost for every user that plays Metro 2033 on the same CPU memory combination, it will perform the same, right? If one GPU is going to clock up to 1050, every GPU will clock up to 1050. And that's not the case on NVIDIA's options.
Isn't that called bin sorting? I mean, it's so disingenuous for somebody to be like, you know, all the parts perform exactly the same. Well, it's like if you bin sort them really carefully so that they all perform exactly the same, but that's been one of the running, you know, kind of like one of the biggest openly known secrets in computing is that, hey, you know, people try multiple chips and some of them overclock better than others. And then you set records with them or then you just happen to overclock better. You know, it's funny what people
That's exactly what they do with like their partner overclocked cards.
Right.
Right. But I guess AMD stands and there's some validity to it, I believe, that, hey, you know, when we sell a part, you know, we're selling it not just to our partners, but to the market as a whole. We believe that if we say 7970, it should perform like a 7970 across all these different vendors. Now, what they do with it beyond that and what their marketing and structure is totally up to them. But you know, and the same thing happens on the CPU side, right? So Intel makes a 3770K Ivy Bridge processor, and it's going to perform the same across all these different platforms. Mm-hmm. There's small fluctuations with Turbo Boost, but they're relatively minor. So I think what NVIDIA's kind of done is let they may be doing a little bit less restriction on that binning process, and AMD still has more restrictions with that binning process. You know, but I guess overall, you know, we kind of the PowerTune with Boost is a similar idea. It's a little bit more pragmatic. It's a little bit more specific. It doesn't have the same kind of fluctuations. Performance-wise, what is interesting about this card is that in some cases, actually, I'd say in about half the cases, the 7970 gigahertz is now faster than the GTX 680. Like they've kind of swapped positions again. AMD kind of has the performance lead. Especially at the higher resolutions. So like Battlefield 3 at 1080p, the GTX 680 is still a little bit faster. But if you look at 2560 by 1600, the 7970 gigahertz edition is actually a little bit faster. And we see that repeated on quite a few games. So, you know, if you want that bleeding edge performance and you're looking at triple panel stuff, you know, the 7970 gigahertz edition may, again, be the top performing kind of single GPU option. Obviously, the top performing card is still the GTX 690 with its, you know, dual Kepler GPUs. But there is a downside to this card, and that is the power consumption. We were very impressed with NVIDIA's Kepler when it came to power consumption. The 7970 gigahertz edition actually uses about 30 watts more than the original 7970. Mm-hmm. So the power consumption increase, or, you know, in with the frequency increase is definitely visible, right? And if we compare it that way, you're actually looking at a 60 watt difference between the 680 and the 7970 gigahertz edition. So that's actually pretty significant, right? If you look at the top NVIDIA card and the top AMD card now, you're seeing a 60 watt power consumption difference for cards that are performing very close very close to the same across a large set of games.
Should I mean, when we're talking about desktops, we're talking about, you know, I don't think we've recommended anybody buy anything lower than a 500 watt power supply in recent memory. I mean, 60 watts on a 500 watt or 700 watt power supply. I mean, what's 60 watts between friends, right? Or are we talking about like 60 watts at idle?
No. We're definitely not talking at idle, right? So this is 60 watts under a total load. I would agree with you to a good degree, right? So PC gamers, if you're worried about buying a $500 video card, you're probably not worried about that 60 watts extra power that's being consumed while you're playing Battlefield 3 or whatever game it happens to be. Yes, but if there are some people who that will be a concern for, not necessarily for cost, but maybe for noise, for heating your bedroom. If you live in a dorm with two guys that have two gaming computers, maybe that's a little bit more of a concern. But for maybe the average gamer, you're right. The 60 watts difference isn't going to be that big. Right. I'd say NVIDIA has more a little bit better feature set implementation with this part of the generation. So it's interesting. I would really recommend reading some reviews. Obviously, the one at PCPer.com and
should be first on everyone's list,
right? But you know, get a good idea of like what features and benefits there are either way. But it's interesting to see AMD not kind of sit back and do nothing, right? So some people say this is just an overclocked part. It's kind of a sham, but pretty much all parts are overclocked parts, right? I mean,
yeah. If they can produce it in volume, you think about it this way. We had like, you know, it's the 690, it's the 680. They're amazing. We can't buy them. You know what I mean? If they can ship the part in volume, they can overclock 11, you know, delete expletive out of it, and I'm fine. So, I mean, at this point, it's $1,900 or $1,000 for the 690. The 7970 gigahertz edition, $499. The regular HD 7970, 3 gigabytes, $449. The GeForce GTX 680, $499. And the 670 is coming in around $400. That's pretty much the top five right now.
Yep.
Okay. And if your market, if power consumption is your primary consideration, definitely be looking at one of the NVIDIA parts. And I gotta say, I hadn't thought about, you know, heat on a computer for a while until I finally got our server moved into the front hall closet. And you know, it'll be like, you know, 60 degrees in the front bedroom, and it'll open up the hall closet and the waves of heat will come out, and it's like, wow, I don't even have a GPU in this machine. It's just a Core i5 and a motherboard, and I'm like, there's just a lot of heat when that thing's doing not much of anything.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. Summer and heat is fun. So is the Intel Core i5 3470 Ivy Bridge processor with the HD2500 graphics. So it's just a little bit less expensive. What's the performance like on the 3470?
This is a Core i5 part, so it's quad-core Ivy Bridge, no hyper-threading. It gives you a pretty good idea of what the performance is going to be. It obviously depends on your application. You know, if you're single, double, four-threaded application, this is going to perform very, very well. And in some cases, like if you look at what are some of the tests that might show that? If you look at the rendering and scientific results, I believe if you look at, Euler 3D, which is kind of like a fluid dynamics benchmark, the Core i5 3470 actually outperforms the Core i7 3770, which is the top-end Ivy Bridge, at four threads, because the four threads bounce between cores and hyper-threaded cores,
right?
On the highest end SKU, whereas they're only on primary cores on the 3470. So, you know, it has a little bit of advantage that the operating system doesn't have to worry about balancing where those four threads are, making sure that they're, you know, where they need to get the best performance. There's only these four cores, and hyper-threading obviously isn't nearly as efficient as just raw cores are. So once you go above four threads, obviously the 3770 is gonna dominate in those levels. But so in performance, I think most people would be really, really happy with the 3470 in terms of its computing performance, right? You know, it's four cores is gonna be enough for most people. The kind of downside is that it's not a K-series part. It's not an unlocked processor, meaning that your overclocking is somewhat limited. You can't just kind of turn up the multiplier and see how high it goes like you can on the other Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge K-series parts. You know, I was able to hit 4 gigahertz on all four cores, which is like an 800 megahertz increase, which is good. But we were able to hit 4.5 and 4.6 on the other Ivy Bridge parts, the unlocked parts. And this is basically a limit of the fact that we couldn't go higher than the multipliers that we were provided by this chip. So that's one of the downsides to it. It's, you know, also on that same page as the overclocking, you'll see some benchmark or some power consumption numbers that are really impressive. This Core i5 3470 system, and keep in mind that it has a GeForce GTX 560 Ti. If you look at the load power consumption, the next graph down,
right,
it's 100.1 watts under full processor load.
Wow.
So, and this is a really, really powerful system, right? And we saw, I mean, look at the Sandy Bridge. 143, that's a quad-core hyper-threaded. Then you see the 3770K at 117 watts. That's a big decrease, and we're going even, you know, 17 watts less than that with this part. It's really impressive to see how much power you can get out of an incredibly low power consumption envelope. It kind of goes back to our discussion, right, of the 680 versus the 7970. Is does that really matter? I would say not in the majority of cases, but right. In some select cases, it really can. And then when you start seeing, you know, breaking that 100 watt barrier, and again using a discrete graphics card in the system,
right?
That's pretty nice.
Well, I mean, this is also, you know, and as much as I might mock 60 watts in the context of a typical home, right? Because, you know, you think like it's 60 watts, that's a lot of electricity. Then you figure if you're paying like 9 cents a kilowatt, all of a sudden, you know, the numbers don't look as impressive.
Right.
If you're a company that's got 1,000 workstations and you're cutting your power consumption in half, that's a big deal in terms of cost. If you're running a, you know, server farm and you're cutting your power consumption and your heat consumption in a considerable manner, that's a huge gain. All of a sudden, you're spending a lot less money on AC, or you can cram a lot more boxes in the same amount of space. So I gotta admit, Intel's doing some really, really impressive stuff these days. Should we take a moment to talk about what's going on with the sort of, you know, the title of the article, AMD, Vashir, and Beyond, New Design Philosophy Dictates a Faster Place? I mean, what's going on at AMD right now? Because we've already mentioned previously on the show that AMD is kind of like, we can't compete with Intel on raw performance on the chips. We're going to go right. for sort of inexpensive, mass market, middle of the sweet spot CPUs. We've got the better GPU integration because we do graphics better than Intel. But what's going on in terms of larger changes over time over at AMD?
So this is an editorial that Josh wrote for us over at PC Perspective, and it's a really good look at kind of where he thinks the AMD design philosophy is taking them. And it's not strictly, you know, a lot of people are on the bandwagon. I'll admit I was one of them as well. It's like, oh, they're gonna be an ARM design house soon, right? And he's saying that's not necessarily the case. You know, there's a reason why Cray supercomputers is still selecting the AMD Bulldozer architecture for some of their supercomputers, right? There are benefits and to the design that AMD has gone with. He talks a lot about the editorial for the Vishera, which is the upcoming discrete. I want to say discrete. It's a non-APU. It's just a CPU, right? There's no integrated graphics on this part. And he's saying that from what he's hearing, we're seeing 8 to 10% increases in IPC, which is, you know, performance per clock, instructions per clock, and that we expect these clock speeds to run higher as well. Somewhere in the 3.8, maybe as high as 4 gigahertz mark by default. And if that's the case, these processors coming later in this year, Q3 or Q4, could actually put the lipstick on the proverbial pig of Bulldozer, right? We might actually say, okay, this is actually pile driver, and it's not just pile driver, it's pile driver with a little bit more added onto it as well. And maybe we've figured out the process, and we're able to get clock speeds to a place where we are comfortable with. And do I think they're going to, you know, be able to really, really just nail in Intel to the wall with something like this? No, right. I don't think that's going to be the case, because I still think Intel has tons of headroom that they're just holding back on anyway. There's a reason the highest end Ivy Bridge part is a 77 watt part. If they wanted to make a 120 watt part, they could clock that sucker really high. AMD doesn't have to win to be useful. They just need to be competitive, right? So it will be interesting to see kind of how this works out. There's a lot of details in the article in terms of about Vishera. If you've never heard about this part, it's a 32 nanometer pile driver based processor. There's a little bit of information there on the next generation APU that will be based on this and how that kind of measures out. But if you're curious about what AMD's stances are going to be and their chances of going into the end of 2012 and 2013, it's definitely worth a read.
Very good. Something people should be paying attention on. It started as Light Peak a few years ago in Intel technology. It was going to be like, you know, better than USB, better than 1394, better than eSATA. It morphed into Thunderbolt, using copper, a modified USB connection, instead of fiber optic. It showed up basically Thunderbolt, of course, being the Macintosh name for it. Well, actually, it turns out to be the name for it, Thunderbolt, yep. Showing up on PCs. Gigabyte this week launched the first dual Thunderbolt motherboard, which basically means, you know, bidirectional 10 gigabit per second data pipeline, can do PCI Express. go one more article down. There should be an article for Gigabyte on that one. Because that was the picture of one of the original Intel mock-ups you saw for Thunderbolt.
Right.
So basically, with two Thunderbolt ports, you can actually power up to 12 devices and two displays simultaneously. So Gigabyte's launched the world's first fully certified dual-port Thunderbolt motherboards. And you've been spending a lot of quality time with motherboards from Asus and I want to say...
MSI.
Okay, MSI. So it's like, it can't be Gigabyte because Gigabyte just started to get rolling. How do you like it so far? How's the benchmarking been?
You know, I have to say I came away more impressed than I thought I was going to be with my overall Thunderbolt experience. I spent a lot of time kind of playing with it and making sure that things worked the way that they were supposed to work before really wanting to write it. And the first motherboard we used was actually the Asus P8Z77V Premium. This board was kind of like the first to get officially certified, and it had the best implementation of it and all that kind of stuff. So we wanted to use that one first just to get a good idea of a baseline for what we'd expect from Thunderbolt. Mm-hmm. And overall, I've been pretty impressed. So, you know, what's interesting to me about Thunderbolt is that, keep in mind, it is an extension of PCI Express. So all the stuff that I was able to test today, you know, is basically external storage and a monitor. But the premise for Thunderbolt is much, much greater than that, right? We've seen at CES, we saw external graphics card docks. We've seen external extensions of systems for installing multiple controller cards. There's all kinds of things that can happen, connecting two PCs directly over, you know, this 10 gigabit per second connection. These are all ideas that will happen. But today, like, the primary focus of Thunderbolt is docks,
external hard drives,
that kind of stuff. Yeah. So our first testing, we actually got in a Pegasus R4, which is a 4-drive SATA 6 external storage unit, essentially. What's really cool is when you plug it in, now what's interesting, you don't have to have there's no drivers for the Thunderbolt controller. It just works because it kind of becomes an extension of the PCI Express bus. If you look on the first page of that article and you go all the way down, you see this really interesting looking like branching of all these PCI standard PCI to PCI bridges. Right. And this kind of shows you what everything looks like as it's all connected and that kind of stuff. But you don't need drivers for that, but you may need drivers for devices, because essentially by plugging in a Thunderbolt device, you are essentially telling the system that it's plugged in, as if it were plugged into a PCI Express slot. So when we plugged in this Pegasus R4, you know, it shows up as a RAID controller, and when you install the driver for it, it shows up as a SATA 6G RAID controller, as if it were, you know, installed in your system. So it shows up in your computer management in terms of how it shows up as a storage device. Mm-hmm. It shows up just as a drive letter. It shows up as an internal drive as opposed to an external drive connected by any kind of network or anything like that, which is really nice, just in terms of software compatibility for certain things. You know, the long story short, the performance, I was out of a single drive. I have a single unit using 4 7200 RPM hard drives. We were able to hit, like, I think 700 megabytes per second.
Wow.
And then when I swapped those out for 4 SSDs just to try to squeeze the most out of it possible, I think we got like 920 megabytes per second read capability out of it, which is really good, right? It's not, the theoretical peak is 1.25 gigabytes, but once you take overhead and everything like that, you're looking at, you know, about 1 gigabyte per second as your maximum. So we're getting pretty close to that. And for the first implementation on the first pieces of hardware that have really been available, that's actually pretty good. I also
got my hands on. And that's with a monitor running in the background also?
Or? Yeah. So what's interesting is the monitor has no effect on the bandwidth at all.
That's really cool.
It runs on different channels inside the connection. So remember, a Thunderbolt cable will transmit PCI Express data and then on a separate kind of plane, DisplayPort data. So DisplayPort connection works just like a DisplayPort monitor in any other way, but it doesn't affect the data connection at all. So we actually had several, we actually had two of the R4 units and a monitor hooked up, and we had no issues. And we were using the Apple Thunderbolt display, and it has cool stuff on it like integrated speakers, gigabit Ethernet, a camera, FireWire USB, that kind of stuff on the back of it. Now, we don't have Windows drivers for a lot of that stuff yet, but the integrated sound was working, and we were able to, you know, we were listening to music, playing a game while doing the 910 megabytes per second transfer rates. And we really didn't have any issues at all. And once we had the drivers installed and everything set up, you know, it was hot plug almost as easy as USB. I think maybe one or two times we had to reboot the machine for it to recognize it. You know, and that was when we had like a couple of them daisy chained type of deal. But I was really impressed with the whole experience, actually.
Did you do any sort of comparison between USB 3.0 performance versus Thunderbolt performance?
Not directly. And the reason I would say that is if you have a single drive, SSD or hard drive that you need for external storage, if you have Thunderbolt on your system, you can use it. But USB 3.0 is going to be fine because USB 3.0 maxes out at 5 gigabits per second. The current generation of Thunderbolt does 10 gigabits.
Right.
You're really only going to take advantage of that amount of bandwidth that you have with Thunderbolt if you have like these professional level devices, if you have this big external RAID array, that type of thing. I know Seagate is selling a Thunderbolt adapter for like 2.5-inch hard drives, which it works. We've tested one, but you know, you're kind of maxed out at like the 300 to 350 megabytes per second with regardless of what SSD you're going to use, maybe up as high as 4, but it's about the same performance as USB 3.0 because the bottleneck is actually the drive. It's not actually the connection.
Right.
So in order to, I mean, that's why it seems crazy. We had 4 SATA 6G SSDs and a RAID 0 array on this external unit just to try to push as much bandwidth as we could. It's expensive for a consumer product. It's maybe not as useful yet because there's not a whole lot of devices to take advantage of it. But I think that the idea is professionals will get this in their hands. They'll see how it will be useful. It will come down in price, and we will see implementations for consumers of pretty much all price ranges.
Are there any hints at this point that the cable costs are going to come down? Because right now there are basically $50 cables. Some of them are 2 meters long. Some of them are 6 meters long. They all basically, it's amazing because it's cable that has a whole bunch of chips at one end of it. I want to say 12
at both ends,
pardon me. Anyway, which is part of what gives us this amazing performance and the ability to sort of do all this broadband in the purest sense of the lots of signals on the same copper kind of thing. But $50 for a cable is expensive. You buy a hard drive, there's no Thunderbolt cable in the box, because Seagate doesn't want to eat that gigantic cost or make their 1 terabyte drive suddenly look ridiculously expensive.
Intel has said that the prices on these cables are going to come down. I think we've seen one cable, but it's also been $49.
Right.
There's
basically Apple and two other cables you can buy on the internet. And they're all like, $49 or $50.
What's funny is the end of the cable with that logic in it actually gets warm to the touch while you're using it as well because of the logic in there. It's responsible for kind of separating the DisplayPort and PCI Express data on the fly type of thing. $50 cables aren't what we need for this to work, right? We need smarter versions of this in the 20 or 30 range for sure.
10.
Okay, we'll do that.
$10 range.
Let's set the right goals.
$10, Intel. We should take a moment to thank one of our sponsors. Squarespace is bringing the show to you today. Ryan, could you tell us a little bit more about them?
I would love to, Patrick. I would love nothing more. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has a lot of great features that even if you're a first-time website builder or an experienced website builder, that you're really going to love to take advantage of. They have an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing that website or blog. Free domain registration for annual plan customers. That's actually a good deal. Domain selection and mapping is completely integrated with the sign-up process. So if you're a newbie to the world of building a website and registering a domain and doing something, they'll handle all that kind of stuff for you. As I said, it's optimized for both beginners and experts, right? So if you want to get into the nitty-gritty CSS coding side of things, you can absolutely do that. They give you all the tools for that. You don't I don't know if you have the capability to download a CSS file, edit it in your editor, and upload it, or you can edit it online as well as you go, kind of on the fly. But if you're not into that, they have tons of templates, and you can start with one. You can do modifications. You can easily kind of like drag and drop these features and segments around, and to really customize it to your content, right? You can do a little bit. You can do a lot. You can load up a website and have it registered and started running in 5 minutes if you want to. Or if you want to spend a couple of days and make sure it's something perfect, you can absolutely do that. They have free live webinar classes to help you get the most out of your Squarespace site or blog. It is an all-inclusive service, which means it includes modules to build your website, like the blog module, the form builder, Flickr photo displays, Twitter widgets, social media buttons to connect to Facebook and Twitter, Google Maps, all that kind of stuff. It also has website tracking, so you know how many times your site is viewed. It has a search engine optimizer. It has permission access handling, so if you have multiple users that you want to kind of post to your site, you can control what things they can and can't do, right? Which is a good idea. And as importantly, it's built on a cloud architecture, which means that it's architected for site stability and speed, right? You don't have to worry about getting a whole bunch of traffic and your site going down. You don't have to worry about losing a hard drive on a server and everything's lost, right? They do a good job of keeping all that, maintaining everything, making sure the site is ready for any kind of traffic that it might get. You should definitely check out Squarespace for all of your website needs. You use them to build it, to host it, update it at any time. For a free trial, this is great. For a free trial, all you have to do is go to squarespace.com. No specific URL. Just go to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. You just try it out, start building your website right away. If you decide to purchase it, you can use offer code TWICH7. That's TWICH7. And you can get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. Don't forget about free domain registration with annual plan subscription. So if you want to get the most value out of it, you know, sign up for the free account, see how much you love the service, use that offer code TWICH7, TWICH7, and get 10% off and your free domain as well. That's squarespace.com, offer code TWICH7, and we thank Squarespace for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thank you, Squarespace. So we teased about this, and I apologize to everybody who's a regular listener. We did not have a show last week due to what I will affectionately call scheduling difficulties that involved both Ryan and I traveling at the speed of light without the benefit of transporter. Wow. Yeah, I exaggerate slightly there. A bit of the hyperbole. But you did, in fact, build a PC while blindfolded.
I did.
Did you have to put the little screws in the motherboard? That was the part I couldn't figure out a way to do.
I did. That took a long time. And I tell you what, I ended up giving up and only doing 3 of the 6 or 8 that were there. I was just like, ah, screw it. I'm tired of this. I'm moving on. It was a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be. I built an AMD Llano-based APU system. You can see a little screenshot of me with my scarf wrapped around my face. It also got very hot underneath that scarf.
I bet it did.
So I vastly underestimated the amount of time it was going to take me to build this system. It was fun to do, but I think my last guess was probably like in the 30 to 40 minute range. And Ken, yeah, look at that. This is just like opening stuff up, and I started knocking stuff off the table, and it was.
So it normally might take you 10, maybe 20 minutes. Right. Probably 10 minutes if the motherboard screwed into the case, you know, maybe 20 minutes on the outside if you stop for a cup of coffee to build a PC normally. Blindfolded, it took you
an hour and 18 minutes.
Wow.
And that, obviously, I didn't have to do the OS install. We already had, Ken had already set everything up and made sure that it all run. Uh-huh. It all ran okay, and it had an OS installed on the hard drive and that kind of stuff. The most difficult parts, spreading the thermal paste. which I could hear Ken laughing at me while I was doing it, and when I watched the video playback, I was like, wow, that was really awful. Yeah, you can see this. Like, I think I have it on there, and you're squeezing it out, right? And you don't want to get it on your hands. And I actually do get it on the processor, but then I try to like what you're supposed to do. You take a little business card and you smooth it out on the top of it, and I thought I had did a good job, but Ken was laughing at me the whole time, and I knew something was going amiss. So you can see, I put it like right on the edge of the processor. It's not the best practice to be to be perfectly honest. It was fun. It was an interesting Saturday project. We'll put it that way. If you haven't seen the video, go to PCPro.com. Just search for blindfolded, and it will hopefully be the first result that comes up. Because otherwise, I don't know what else we're doing. So yeah.
Oh my goodness. So Google I/O was last week. We'll just do a brief mention. The two biggest pieces of hardware that people in the Twitch audience are probably curious about: the Nexus 7 tablet, which I had my grubby little paws on. It's interesting because they're using a multi-core processor. It's a very fast tablet, but a lot of what you're feeling with the speed of the tablet has less to do with the actual processor in the tablet than Buddha, which is part of Jelly Bean, which I did an interview with our CTO, Rob DeMillo, and Rob was like, this should not be a 0.1 update. This should be like a go not 4 to 4.1. This should be 4.1 to 5. This should be a 5.0 update. This is a big update. They did a lot with it. But Butter does some interesting things in how threads are handled and prioritizing the graphics handling inside the device. Basically, the application in front of you gets prioritized instead of just sort of sitting there in the queue with everything else. So the Nexus 7 looks like a gorgeous tablet. It feels good in the hand. The display is very nice. A little more confusing is the Nexus Q, which I heard, you know, we didn't talk about this on Techzilla when we were talking about it, because it's kind of funny because it's an orb. It's a ball. It's about the size of an orb speaker. So it's got a full, like, audiophile grade amplifier built into it with these massive jacks, like banana jacks on the back of it. It's essentially a fully functional Jelly Bean Android 4.1 device. It's got HDMI. Okay. It's got Ethernet. And it's got a spinny top. And I thought it was supposed to come off, and DeMillo, I thought he was going to kill me.
Did you break it? Well, no, I
didn't break it. I dropped it at one point. It's heavy. The thing weighs about 4 pounds because of the power supply, or 9 pounds. It's heavy. I wouldn't want to be hit in the head with one. It would be
gotcha.
Colonel Ryan in the kitchen with the Nexus Q, to make a Clue reference. But the thing that people are postulating after Google I/O is that it's actually Google's attempt not so much to put a media device or a set-top box, because essentially that is a set-top box. It's a set-top box. It's a Sonos competitor. It only works with Google Play. There's no third-party video services on there. But they think it may be what they want people to use to bring Android gaming and Android applications onto their HDTVs. But it's heavy. It's expensive. It's like $400. Excuse me, $300. For some reason, I thought it was $400, possibly because it's so heavy. It's an interesting device. I'm really curious to see what the sales on that are going to be like. And I'm really curious to see if they're going to open up the ecosystem on that or just kind of keep it very Google Play centric. Because Google is very much trying to, because the Nexus 7, the amazing thing about the Nexus 7 is it's fast and it's like $200. It is ridiculously cheap for what you're getting, and it's certainly a shot across the bow at Amazon, because at this point, it's less about the hardware for Google than it is about competing with the iTunes ecosystem and the Amazon ecosystem for controlling the pipeline of content to your face,
right?
Which seems to be where the majority of the money is coming from. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to talk about this particular device too much. I thought it was interesting. I don't know. My interest in it was a replacement for Sonos, a replacement for AirPlay, like those types of things. In terms of the media stuff, precisely, you know, it's like, okay, that's pretty cool. But $300 is a lot to swallow for that kind of device.
I think it may be one of those things where it ends up with this really dense core of enthusiasts who love it because it's this, you know, this amazing amplifier and they can send audio to it.
Well, they mentioned hackability in the presentation, right? Like, and they got a huge round of applause.
Right.
So, you know, I think they're going at that audience.
That's
for sure.
Well, you know, that's a big part
There's
of the
intelligence
Android audience.
There, as long as you can hit both sides, right? You know, you can't ignore the mainstream, otherwise you make a product that's not going to be successful.
Well, and even Apple, who's been so successful with so many devices, still considers the Apple TV a hobby, and the Apple TV is a $100 device that works fairly flawlessly.
Yep.
Windows 8, they've announced the cost for that, or at least the upgrade cost, $39 for the upgrade. For the Windows 8 Pro upgrade is going to be $39, which is important for me and for my buddy Robert Heron on HD Nation, because, of course, that means you get Windows Media Center because you need Pro to get Media Center, which kind of sucks, but I don't want to get cranky about that. Dell is building Ubuntu notebooks if you've been looking for a pre-built system. I've had my hands on Dell's XPS 13 Ultrabook, and they just also released 14 and 15-inch editions of the Dell notebooks, the XPS notebooks. They feel fantastic. They are obviously very sort of influenced design-wise by the MacBook Pros. But if you, you know, Dell recently announces turning on an open source Linux OS to craft a developer focused operating system enabled by Dell's incubation program and accompanying monetary funding. The pilot program named Project Sputnik is based on Dell's XPS 13 Ultrabook and Ubuntu 12.04 LTS OS. So it's going to run for 6 months and they're trying to figure out sort of an ideal software hardware balance for developers. And so if you're kind of into getting your Linux on, take a look at what's going on over at Dell. And you have the most redonkulous, and I hate using that word in public.
As you should.
I would like to apologize to the listening audience, especially all the people who just canceled their subscription to the show. It's an NVIDIA GTX packed in what looks like, I don't even know how to describe this. Just put it up on screen, Burke. Get it up there. It's huge. It is a passively cooled NVIDIA GTX 680. And while we may talk about how much more thermally efficient or power efficient the GTX, the NVIDIA chips are compared to the AMD chips, you get an idea of just exactly how much heat you're still having to radiate when you look at this. Like, is this like a 9 PCI Express slot wide GPU? See that little slip in the middle? That's the GPU. And everything else...
I don't even cooler. Know. Does it say? Let's see. This is what's interesting to me. So the company that's making this is called Colorful.
Right.
And I tried to look up some information on Colorful as a company. I was like, let's get in touch with these guys, see if they actually want to send us one to test. And it was, let's say, difficult. It's a Korean, Japanese, Chinese company that doesn't have really English website type stuff, but they, you know, sent out this little PR about this passively cool GTX 680. Now, keep in mind that this cooler, in theory, has to be rated at being able to passively cool 250 watts, 220 watts.
So there's two massive. If you scroll down a little bit, you see there's two massive heat sinks. There it is. So that's one half of the cooling device. There's three heat pipes on that. You flip it over. There's like three heat pipes on the other side, apparently.
Yeah, this thing is connected at the top with a six heat pipe connection.
I'm guessing four slots for this thing, it looks like, because it's got at least.
And what's interesting is because so much of it is behind the GPU, you have to have you may not be able to put this in your primary PCI Express slot. It may have to go in your secondary PCI Express slot because of how much, you know, depending on your motherboard design, how close you are to the processor itself.
So no shipping information, no purchasing information. But if you want top line GPU performance and want no noise, this is certainly an option.
I just need to be proved that it works. I need to put it in a system and loop Metro 2033 for like 6 hours and see what parts of it melt because you are
skeptical at the possibility of dissipating the better part of 300 watts without the use of fans.
Right.
That and is a reasonable.
Like if you have to have a lot of case fans to move air across it, it kind of defeats the purpose.
Right.
So, you know, if they send me one, I'm going to try to build a completely silent, fanless PC with it. I'll use that as the GPU, and I'll use
that would be cool.
I don't know what CPU. Really cool. I'll have to find like the biggest heatsink I can for CPUs as well, but I don't.
And then you can build a giant case for it, and then you can water cool it or fill it with floor inerts. Twitch, TWICH at twit.tv is our email address. We love your questions. We're going to answer a couple of them in a second. We want to ask you to do us a favor. If you enjoy the show, do us a favor. Tell your friends about it. Email a link to it. Best link you can use as far as we're concerned is twit.tv/twitch. Twit.tv/twitch is where you can subscribe to the show if you haven't done that already. So please come check that out. We love it when you subscribe through any device because we want you here to join us every week. And Twitch at twit.tv is the email address. Our first question comes from Adam. Hello, Twitch crew. With all the great graphics cards out there, I'm getting an itch to upgrade. My current setup is two ATI AMD 5870 cards in a Crossfire configuration and a 24-inch Dell UltraShot monitor running at 1920 by 1200. I do not plan on upgrading the monitor to a larger resolution anytime soon, but I am having problems picking a good value card with great performance at that resolution. The NVIDIA 670 is at the high end of my budget and would be a great option, as would the AMD 7800 series, especially with their prices. The other option is to stay with my current setup until the next generation is on the market. I play first-person shooters like Modern Warfare 3, Battlefield, Medal of Honor, and we'll be playing Far Cry 3 when it comes out later in the year. What should I do? Thanks, Adam.
The 670 is the high end of the budget. A pair of 5870s is still a pretty good configuration for a 19 by 12 set of hardware. So he's saying to the next generation of the market, the next generation of GPUs, when will that be? I don't know. I would say you're probably leaning towards maybe late 2012 to see like a new super high-end part.
Right.
But I wouldn't expect to see anything else in the lower end stuff than what we have today. So with that being the case, I think if you have the itch to upgrade, that now is a great time because there's tons of great products out there. What I would like to see still that does not really exist is the sub $400 NVIDIA options. Like I'm really eager to see what the 660 card is going to be like from NVIDIA. If they're going to have a 660 Ti, if we'll have a standard one, the 670 at $399 is a great card. It really is. And so is the 7950 and the 7970, which you can get close to those prices too. But I know in my gut that what people are really waiting for is that new $199 card or the new $250 card that's really going to, from NVIDIA, it's really going to push things. The 7800 cards are in that range, and while they're great options, you still want to know what both vendors are going to do maybe before you make that final decision.
Uh-huh.
So I don't see any harm in maybe waiting a little bit longer. Either, right? So yeah. Far Cry 3, when it comes out later in the year. But if you're looking at it, you're like, wow, I want to play Battlefield 3 now, then if you can afford a 670, go that route. If you can if you want to go 7950 or 7970, look at those prices, because you can get a 7970 for $429 now, I think, $419. Those have come down quite a bit.
I mean, if he's currently playing, he's currently playing Modern Warfare 3, Battlefield, Medal of Honor. I would almost say, as much as you want to buy a GPU now, wait until Far Cry 3 comes out and see if it saves you the cost of a copy of Far Cry 3 when you buy the GPU. Because it's funny.
That's true.
The closer you get to Christmas, the more off the cliff the prices on the cards are going to go. Especially if they release a new high-end card out around that. All of a sudden, everything that was, $400 is $350, $350 is $300, $300 is closing. It's just the longer you wait, the less money you'll spend. Mm-hmm. Or you'll buy an even faster processor and spend even more. Which brings us to Josh. He says, hi, guys. I love the podcast and listen to every new episode when it arrives. Thank you, Josh. My question is regarding upgrading my ancient Radeon HD 4830 that currently lives in my gaming machine. What card would you recommend for $200 playing today's games and maxed out settings? My current rig is a Core i7-920 overclocked at 3.9 gigahertz with 6 gigs of DDR3 RAM. Thanks for the advice. Keep up the good work, Josh. Thank you, Josh. It's kind of funny. You were just mentioning we're kind of waiting quietly.
Right.
For the new $200 sort of sweet spot. This is kind of the classic, serious, affordable gaming card price is going to be around $200. Do we expect it anytime soon?
It's hard to say. Like, I would think we would have to. I honestly don't know when it will be. So, the best card in that kind of $200 price range now is probably going to be your the 7850.
Uh-huh.
So if you look at the Radeon HD 7850... you can get those for $229 with the rebates. So as low as $209 with rebates. So that's a little bit over his $199 price range. But to be honest with you, the drop from $7,850 to $7,770 is really dramatic in terms of performance. So I would definitely say suck it up and buy the $7,850 if you're going to go down that route. Because I mean, the price drop goes from $239 to $129, right? So I mean, that's way too big. I would say I mean, it's got to be sometime this summer. I mean, it has to be sometime this summer that we'll see NVIDIA's lower than 670 products in the Kepler family, right? It's really interesting to see because, so keep in mind, Kepler is built on GK104. That's the chip it's built on. The GK107, which is the next one down in terms of performance, is in the GT640, I think is what it was. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago, and it's a dog, and it's just a bad part. So they're going to have to take GK104, cut off some more of those SMX units, right? Make it a little bit lower cost and go down that route. So, you know, I have a feeling that it will be maybe by the end of the summer. If you make that decision to buy 7850 today, it's not going to be a bad product. It depends on how easily you get buyer's remorse.
And if you have it easily, wait until later this summer, yeah. Which is a painful thing to say. How about an affordable, reliable solid-state drive for Ty? I'm kind of jealous of Ty's son. Ty writes in, "Hey guys, let me say that I love the podcast. You guys really help me stay awake and pass the time on my 3-to-11 shift at FedEx. Glad we can help. Anyway, my question is about SSDs. I have an 8-gigabyte Intel SSD right now, and I want one that's a little bigger, say 128 gigabytes, and then I can pass down the Intel to my son's rig that I just built. Lucky child. I don't trust OCZ as a system drive. I've heard too many bad things, and I'm not sure about Corsair either. I was thinking Samsung's 830, but I've seen the Crucial SSDs for a little less money. Which would you recommend? Thanks in advance. And Patrick, I just wanted to say that I still miss the screensavers." Well, so do I. Sincerely, Ty in Phillipsburg, New Jersey. Samsung 830, great value so far. Mm-hmm. Reliability has been excellent. I think you can probably trust the OCZ or the Corsair. There have been issues with OCZ, but everybody at one point or another in the SSD world seems to have had issues.
It was more an issue with a SandForce controller and firmware. Right. And the thing is, OCZ just sold more of those controller-based drives than anybody else.
Right.
So that kind of, that, you know, it's unfortunate they got that stigma. You know, and maybe they are worse, a little bit worse than others, but they're definitely not the only ones. The 830s are great drives. This is an interesting time for SSDs because I think we're right at that cusp where prices are going to fall, and I think they're going to stay there. The last couple of weeks, we've seen mini drives under $1 a gigabyte. But, you know, you'll come back the next week and they'll be back up to like $1.25 a gigabyte. So it really depends on what you get that week. And it's kind of a good idea to maybe keep an eye on a lot of those deals, right? You know, you can set pricing alerts to a lot of these guys. Maybe go to the Samsung 830 and say, okay, as soon as it drops below, you know, the 500 gig version drops below $500, let me know. Those types of things. But yeah, we're right on the cusp. Still, a 1 terabyte drive would be that's a heck of an upgrade.
That is a heck of an upgrade. And lucky son, I'm going to say it one more time. That's actually going to wrap it for this edition of Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. Again, I'd like to apologize for anybody who missed the show last week, not because you missed it, but because we didn't make one because we had some traveling problems that the internet failed us.
It did.
And we all suffered as a result. Twitch, TWICH, at twit.tv is the email address. And do us a favor, if you haven't subscribed, go to twit.tv/Twitch and tell your friends, forward a link to the podcast to them. If you got some people out there that are into hardware. And as always, we've said it before, we'll say it again. We want your questions. Email them to us, Twitch, TWICH at twit.tv. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
Until next time, we'll see you. Well, we'll see you on Twitch next week, I promise.